Part 2. Planetary Connections. Chapter 7. Tide. On calm days, I would watch for hours from different points the movement of the flood into the bay, and as far as I could, map it, tracing in front of me the lanes of polished water which gave away the currents of tide weight beneath them. With each tide, those lines vary, with the weather, the state of the pressure systems rolling out of the Atlantic to the west, the time of year and the thickness of the weed, the time of day, the direction of the wind. It is said to flood here 12 minutes later than at Oban, the reference port, but that varies too, sometimes earlier, sometimes later. No wonder people could think the tide in some way animate, motivated not simply by mechanical action, but by some hidden, purposeful being beyond our understanding. Its behaviour is less like the falling of a latch into its socket than the half-predictable, half-uncertain gestures of a living thing. The way it finds its path around this shore is like a dog nosing in the shallows. It may be gravity in action, but this is gravity doing more than dropping an apple from a tree. Nothing is to be seen in the way this gravity's levers are pulled. All we can feel, as Ronald Blythe said of his time staring at the beach in Aldborough in Suffolk, is that we are watching the sea on a cosmic leash. A rising tide, in Hugh Aldersey Williams's disturbing phrase, is the only time we see something falling up. Imagine for a moment that you have no preconceptions, that Newton had never lived, and that you watch the tide rising and falling, today, the rest of this week, for months, for year after year. What do you know? Only what Pliny in his Historia Naturalis, published in AD 77, knew, that there are two high and two low tides a day, that they tend to follow the high point of the moon's arc in the sky by about 3 hours, that spring tides and neap tides vary with the moon, and that tides at the equinoxes in March and September are larger than those at the solstices in June and December. Not only does the tide come and go twice a day, its coming and going comes and goes twice a month and twice a year. What is this pattern? What does it say about the nature of things? From the beginning, from long before the written word, the questions of influence and causality were bound up with the pattern of the tides. There were tides in more than the sea, and the moon was part of it. Shellfish grew with the moon's increase. The blood in a man's veins and arteries wavered in proportion to her light. Leaves and vegetables felt her influence. The moon was female, and the flow of menstrual blood, called the waters in Gaelic, was governed by her. Her power penetrates all things, Pliny wrote. We may certainly conjecture that the moon is not unjustly regarded as the star of our life. She it is that replenishes the earth. When she approaches, she fills all bodies. When she recedes, she empties them. That concordance of sea and self is one of the oldest of all human metaphors. Sir James Fraser, attending to the rude philosophy of sympathy and resemblance, described in the Golden Bough how dwellers by the sea sense in the flood tide not merely a symbol but a cause of exuberance, of prosperity and of life, while in the ebbing tide they discern a real agent as well as a melancholy emblem of failure, of weakness, and of death. The old word for high tide in use until the 18th century was the swell, meaning not, as it does today, the long rolling waves from old storms, but the enlargement of the sea itself with the rising waters. The swell was the time of filling, the impregnation of the sea, the moment of fulfilment. In the West Highlands, eggs, if they were to result in hen birds, were to be set under hens during the ebb, and for dominant cocks, during the flood. In Brittany, as Fraser heard, the people thought that clover, sown when the tide is coming in, will grow well, but that if the plant be sown at low water or when the tide is going out, it will never reach maturity, and that the cows which feed on it will burst. The best butter was churned when the tide had just paused at low slack water and was beginning, in that most expressive and beautiful of sea expressions, to make, as if the tide were self-creating. Milk which foamed as it came from the cow would go on foaming until the hour of high water was past. Water drawn from the well or milk taken from the cow while the tide was rising would boil up in the pot and overflow into the fire. The ebb also had its potency. According to some, the skins of seals, even after they had been parted from their bodies, remained in secret sympathy with the sea and were observed to ruffle when the tide was on the ebb. People have always thought creatures died on the ebb. For some, Fraser had heard it was true in Wales and on the Breton coast, babies were born on the flood and the old expired on the ebb. It is an identification as ancient as Aristotle, repeated by Pliny. Shakespeare had Falstaff die, sick at last with the falsity and wickedness of men, just at the high point of the slack. Even at the turning of the tide, rejoining the natural rhythm of the world as the sea started to drain from the shore. In the Highlands, the haunted cry of the black-throated diver was a knell for the dropping of the waters, sounding in Gaelic like Dioch, 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 Sun Loch a Trachic. Drink, 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 the sea is ebbing from the loch. Tides have long been a perplexity. Aristotle was said to have drowned himself because he fell into despondency at not understanding how they came and went at Chalcis in the channel between Euboea and the mainland of Greece, sometimes all day in the same direction, sometimes changing direction 14 times between morning and night. Confusion reigned. Eratosthenes, following Aristotle, thought that different parts of the sea were of different heights, and the tide flowed between them as if down a riverbed. But how and when, even his contemporaries asked, did the water flow back? Medieval monks repeated much of what Pliny and everyone else who ever looked at the sea had understood, but there was no progress in grasping the workings of the tides between the 1st century AD and the scientific revolution 1,600 years later. In the Renaissance, theories were not lacking. Some followed Apollonius, the 1st century AD philosopher from Cappadocia, who thought the earth and sea were part of a living creature, which, by its respiration, causeth this ebbing and flowing. Others imagined the tides were stirred up by the maelstrom at Saltstraumen, a great whirlpool near Norway, which for 6 hours absorbs the water and afterwards disgorges it in the same space of time. It was suggested that the general motion of the sea, driven westwards in sympathy with the movement of the moon across the sky, was obstructed by the bulk of the Americas, and that European tides were those seas reflected back across the Atlantic. Bernardo Telesio, an early and pioneering natural philosopher from Calabria in the south of Italy, assumed that the sea rose and tended to boil over when heated by the sun. Wanting to preserve itself, as all bodies do, the sea set itself in motion to avoid evaporation, and so generated the flow and ebb of the tides. Our daily sense of the tide is not very different from all these forgotten and redundant ways of understanding it, which linger on in our minds like the flotsam and jetsam of the tide mark itself. For all the geniuses that have addressed the question over the last 400 years, the actual behaviour of the wave motions and all the vast undulations of the ocean remained formidably difficult to understand, full of local variation, distorted by bay and headland, so that the tide, in detail, remains a lurking mystery. We may know, thanks to Kepler and Newton, that it is to do with gravity, but do we know what that is beyond some mathematical constant? The long story of the tide's motions has been framed around a dialogue of opposites. Are they governed by what is hidden, the occult, an unexplained power, as the empiricist philosophers of the 17th century like to call it, or by something that can be perceived in the material and mechanical world? Can we know the tides, or must we rely for our understanding, in the end, on some strange and unknowable force? Two of the great formative minds of the pre-Newtonian scientific revolution were arrayed on either side of that question. Galileo, for earthly mechanics, the great German mathematician and astronomer Johannes Kepler, for mysterious cosmic powers. For Kepler, mind and matter were not distinct. The bodies of Earth, Moon, the other planets and the Sun all had within them a sense of purpose and the capacity for affection. What Kepler, in the Astronomia Nova, 1609, called his true theory of gravity, involved forces that went beyond the merely mechanical. The mutuality was most apparent in magnets, and for a while Kepler, like Francis Bacon, thought that magnetism may have been the driving force of the solar system as a whole. But this sense of attractiveness was also a universal principle, applicable to all things. Earth and Moon were like each other, and because of that affinity had come together in the heavens as one system. At certain moments in the search, the philosopher of science, Ernan McMullen, has written, when plausible physical explanations prove difficult to come by, Kepler had tentatively resorted to explanation in terms of a planetary mind capable of steering its home planet. The planets had something Kepler called perceptive cognition, a directing mind. And ocean tides, the most fluid and mobile elements on Earth, were a manifestation of that thinking and feeling planet, of a connection between the Earth and its great satellite. For Kepler, long celebrated as the great rational mathematical genius, the first to establish through the painstaking analysis of Tycho Brahe's many careful observations of the night sky that the planets orbited the Sun on elliptical paths, nevertheless thought that the liquid sea had an affection for the Moon. If the Earth ceased to attract, to itself, the waters of the sea, he wrote, they would rise and pour themselves over the body of the Moon. Kepler's mysterious animate world has a rich and melancholy beauty. Things are separate, but they yearn to be together. Objects, stones on the beach, rocks in the sea, the waters themselves are full of longing, and the universe is filled with mutual but unachieved desire. So powerful was this attraction that Kepler knew he had to provide a reason that Earth and Moon were not locked in each other's arms. The phenomenon that needed explaining was not the closeness of the two planets, but the distance that remained between them. What was keeping the planets apart? Why had the Earth's seas not been able to embrace the Moon? His solution was to imagine that the Sun was spreading out beyond itself an immense immaterial swirling and rotating force field, a whirlpool, as Kepler called it, whose arms urged the planets onward in their paths. Two great forces were in tension. The gravitational love between Earth and Moon pulling them together, the solar vortex keeping them apart. Every tide, drawn by the mysterious force called gravity, threw its arms out towards the Moon, which was ever separate from it, held at a distance in the grip of the solar whirlpool. I have stood on the beach and tried to think myself back into Kepler's world, to see the long ebb, the emergence of dark offshore rocks from the coloured skin of water, as a sign that something on Earth is longing to be out there with the Moon, that gravity is a kind of desire, and that the sea is leaving this bay for another because it wants to. There is a story that allows one to move back into Kepler's mental world. One day, the great mathematician and astronomer, after many hours dwelling on the universe and its workings, was called to dinner by his wife, Barbara, who put a salad on the table in front of him. "Do you think," he said to her, "that if, from the day of creation, tin plates, lettuce leaves, grains of salt, drops of oil and vinegar, and pieces of hard-boiled egg were floating in space in all directions and without order, chance could assemble them today to make a salad. Certainly not such a good a one, Mrs. Kepler said, nor so well seasoned. Barbara Kepler's salad takes its place alongside such other things present here now as Ariel Song, Leopardi's arena for his Talitra Saltator, Mandelbrot's wriggled rope, Heraclitus's lyre cum bow, as something emblematic of the questions raised by the tides. The Keplers differ in their approach to life. Johannes, who has been cogitating all morning, thinks that the salad can only be the outcome of a profound order in the organisation of existence. Chance alone could never have brought it into being. Barbara, who has after all cut and washed the lettuce, cooked and peeled the eggs, disagrees. This particular salad on this tin plate, with its sprinkling of salt and oil and vinegar, can only be dependent on what she has done that morning. This salad, here now, this Thursday, in this chipped bowl, on this Czech tablecloth, in this house in Prague in 1604, is what is, whatever might be happening out in the further reaches of the cosmos. It is the deepest of divisions. On one side is Johannes's belief in an order and harmonious universe aligned with the emergent beauties of aerial song and with the assumptions behind any sacrifice to the gods. All three share the assumption, common to religion, philosophy and science, that there is a structure to the world. Barbara Kepler's pride in her salad comes from the opposite position, shared, say, with the patterns of protean flight or the structural anarchy of a breaking wave, the ungraspability of truth. Barbara, Talitrus and the wave do not reflect any overarching system. If there is one, it is not apparent in this world. If it exists at all, it is unreachable, and the ultimate nature of reality is concealed behind an endlessly contingent surface. The breaking surge on the seashore, the tang of Barbara's seasoning, the indifference of wild birds, the quiddity of those things from moment to moment matters to them more than any month-long or year-long unrolling of the tides. And so the depiction of the tide as a form of longing, a mysterious affinity between things at a distance from each other, is an aspect of the need for order, of the assumption that coherence is the ultimate reality, however obscure it might be. Kepler is the philosopher, the descendant of Heraclitus, forever seeking the unknowable logos. Barbara, one of the citizens of Ephesus, knowing her salad, its deliciousness, her care. Kepler's contemporary and rival in Italy, Galileo, had no truck with his mysterious cosmic forces. Galileo was also looking for order, but the order was to be worldly. In about 1595, when he was teaching at the University of Padua, he went often to see friends in Venice. In times of drought, the wells in the Campi ran dry, and fresh water was imported in barges from the mainland at Lisafusina, near the mouth of the Brenta, which was Galileo's embarkation point to cross the brackish lagoon. "Let us consider a large vessel full of water," he wrote, "such as, for example, a large boat like those carrying fresh water from one place to another over salt water. First, we see that as long as the boat stands still, the water contained in it stays equally calm. Then let the boat start moving, not slowly and gradually, but suddenly with great speed. We see the water being left behind, rising towards the stern and subsiding towards the bow, because, unlike the solid parts, the water is not firmly attached to the vessel." In the same way, if the barge stopped suddenly, running into a sandbank in the lagoon, the fresh water in it was pushed up towards the bow, then bounced back toward the stern, doing this several times with ever-decreasing agitation until it returned to a level state. No occult forces were involved. The water merely slopped from one end of the barge to the other, because it was liquid and the barge was not. That image remained with him, and in 1616, Galileo wrote to his patron, Alessandro Orsini, recently made cardinal in Rome, to describe how the coming and going of the sea was not, as the whole of humanity had previously thought, a process of expansion and contraction of seawater, but of true local motion in the sea, a displacement, so to speak, now towards one end and now towards the opposite end of a sea basin. All naive and local observations of the tide had guessed that the rising of the water was the slow and vast upwelling of the sea, like a great boil, in sympathy with the shrinking and swelling of the moon, a bulge of connection between the moist, inconstant planet in the heavens and the moist, inconstant elements on Earth. Galileo was the first person to reject that idea. For him, from the start, the tide was a huge wave, or more precisely, a set of huge waves, lurching to and fro within the ocean basins of the world. John Wallace, an Oxford polymath and one of the founding fellows of the Royal Society, wrote to his friend Robert Boyle in April 1666 about Galileo's basin theory. If a broad vessel of water, for some time evenly carried forward with the water in it, chanced to meet with a stop or to slack its motion, the water will dash forward and rise higher at the forepart of the vessel. And, contrariwise, if the vessel be suddenly put forward faster than before, the water will dash backwards and rise at the hinder part of the vessel. So that an acceleration or retardation of the vessel, which carries it, will cause a rising of the water in one part and a falling in another. Galileo's sea, as Wallace described it, was a loose body carried about with the earth, but not so united with it as necessarily to receive the same degree of impetus with it as its fixed parts do. The rocks might turn on their way, but the planet's rotation would cause a dashing of the water, or rising at one part with a falling at another, the movement that we call the flux and reflux of the sea. Galileo's tidal theory relied on the idea that any point on the Earth daily experienced this stop-start motion. He took from Copernicus that the Earth turned daily on its axis and every year orbited the Sun. Every day, for this bay as for any point on Earth, there is a moment in which we are rotating in the same direction as the planet is orbiting, and so, from the point of view of an observer in the universe, moving relatively fast through space, and another moment 12 hours later, when this point on Earth is turning in a direction opposite to the direction in which the Earth is orbiting the Sun, and seen from a fixed point in space, the bay is moving relatively slowly. Any point on Earth accelerates and decelerates every day. The water in the seas cannot keep up with the movements of the rocky Earth, and so the tidal wave develops, running to and fro, just like water in the barge making its unsteady way across the Venetian lagoon. For Galileo, not only was this an outcome of Copernicus's great insight, it was a proof that the insight was true. The tides revealed the reality of a rotating, orbiting Earth. Dr. Wallace loved this idea. "From the first time that I ever read it," he told his co-fellow of the Royal Society, Edward Boyle, "it seemed to me so very rational that I could never be of other opinion." To attempt a sympathetic understanding of Galileo's theory now takes as much of a leap as imagining Kepler's desire-filled sea. "I have tried it. Look out at the bay. The geese are parading up and down offshore. The house martins are flick-steering in among the trees. But it is not them to which I am attending. It is the movement of this planet in space. The headlands in front of me are slowing down in their daily rotation, but the sea has retained its momentum from before and is still moving faster than the rocks around them. And so, astonishingly, the tide is pouring into the bay from the southeast, filling it on a scale and with a strength that only the planet could manage. But then the movement reaches its end. There is a pause, and the rocks begin to accelerate again. The sea starts to be left behind and drains out towards Duart and the Firth of Lorne. It cannot be true, for two insurmountable reasons. It predicts only one high tide a day, and from the point of view of anyone on Earth, one part of the planet is never rotating faster than any other. Everything, of course, turns at the same speed, and the seas never experience the acceleration or deceleration on which the theory depends. Galileo's barge is no good as a picture of how things are. What could make sense of the tide? How could the sea be moved when nothing seemed to be touching it? What invisible levers were there to shift the waters? The next to attempt an explanation was the great French philosopher René Descartes, as intent as Galileo on providing a purely material solution to the problem. He set the earth and the whole of creation in the flux of a real but undetectable fluid, whose globules whirled unceasingly through the cosmos from day to night and year to year. The solar system contained 14 vortices in this fluid, the suns the most powerful, but all the planets, including the satellites of Jupiter and Saturn, with their own. Since everything was connected, globule to globule, there was no such thing as action at a distance. The planets themselves and the tides on Earth were merely pushed along by the giant globule-thick vortices, as if gravity were a kind of cosmic weather, with pressure systems sweeping through the atmosphere of space. When the moon was full, the substance of this heavenly or ethereal fluid pressed on the Earth, squeezing the sea into low tides and allowing them to bulge out into high tides at the intervening quadrants. Descartes' answer seemed at least possible, but not for long. From early 1664, Isaac Newton, a 21-year-old undergraduate at Cambridge, started to keep a series of little pocketbooks, one for theology, one for maths, and one for chemistry. That year and the following, in the middle of a fourth notebook, Newton began to write out his Questiones Quaedam Philosophicae, ranging through the nature of matter, place, time and motion, the cosmic order, the qualities of fluidity and softness, of violent movement, of hidden powers, of light, colour, vision and sensation in general, he began to question the structure of physical being itself. Under the heading of water and salt, Newton interrogated the tides. Descartes had suggested that when the moon came near the earth, the particles in his lunar vortices squeezed both sea and atmosphere and pushed the Earth out of its usual path. Newton, troubled by the chinks betwixt the globuli, saw that the theory could be tested easily enough. Check, first, if the air pressure in a barometer varied with the tides. It did not. Then check whether the Earth moved out of its vortices, centre by moon's pression, cause not a monthly parallax in Mars, which it would if the moon pushed the Earth out of its usual orbit. It did not. In two brief blows, and in private, the Cartesian theory of vortices had been demolished. But what would replace it? Already in discussion in London was the idea that something like Kepler's magic and affectionate gravity might be controlling the movements of the planets. It was an ancient and accepted principle, stemming from Aristotle, that anything would continue in a straight line if not diverted by another force. What then ensured the planets continued to orbit the sun? The ancients had placed them in crystal spheres, but observations from Ptolemy onwards had revealed the inadequacy of that idea. Slowly the picture had been assembled, Copernicus replacing the Earth with the sun at the centre of the system, Tycho Brahe's meticulous observations of the positions of the planets, Galileo's turning of the telescope onto the heavens, and the revelation that Jupiter had satellites which orbited it, just as Copernicus had suggested the great planets orbited the sun. Kepler's recognition that the planets followed elliptical, not circular, paths. But the mechanism remained unknown. This was the question asked in the mid-1660s, among many others, by the great and cantankerous micrographer Robert Hooke. I have often wondered why the planets should move about the sun according to Copernicus's supposition, being not included in any solid orbs, which the ancients possibly for this reason might embrace, nor tied to it as their centre by any visible strings, and neither depart from it beyond such a degree, nor yet move in a straight line as all bodies that have but one single impulse ought to do. Isaac Newton's great insight was to understand that the moon was falling towards the earth. If you stood on a high mountain and fired a cannonball, it would soon be pulled down in an arc towards the ground. The harder you fired it, the further it would go. If that cannonball was fired from the mountain with ever greater force, it would in the end fall towards Earth in a curved trajectory which was long enough to mean it would never touch the ground, but forever circle the planet to which it was drawn. The stone, like the moon, would be in orbit. The mysterious force that holds the moon to the Earth and the Earth to the sun is the very force that brings a stone or an apple to the ground. It is the force that deflects the planets from travelling in a straight line, and it is the force that draws the sea towards the moon and sun. After long delays, and with the encouragement of Edmund Halley, secretary to the Royal Society, who saw the book through the press, Newton's Principia Mathematica was finally published in July 1687. Halley presented a copy on fine paper to the King, James II, an experienced sea captain who had commanded fleets in wars against the Dutch. To James, Halley explained how Newton had made clear all the surprising phenomena of the flux and reflux of the sea. The sole principle, Halley told the king, was no other than that of gravity, whereby on earth all bodies have a tendency towards its centre, and there is the like gravitation towards the centre of the sun, moon, and all the planets. That was the reason the earth and all the planets were round. A universal clustering of matter would create spherical objects, and if there were no moon or sun, the sea would arrange itself in what Halley called a perfect stagnation, always at the same height, without ever ebbing or flowing. If we were alone in space, the planet would be encased in a shallow, still shell of sea. But the gravity of sun and moon disturbed that equilibrium, and it plainly follows that the sea, which otherwise would be spherical by the pressure of the moon, must form itself into a spheroidal or oval figure, whose longest diameter is where the moon is vertical and shortest where she is in the horizon. This, in the simplest and earliest non-mathematical explanation, is the beauty of the Newtonian picture that unites heaven and earth. The rocky earth rests in space within a very slightly ovoid sea, a solid yolk within an elongated watery egg. The moon's gravity both pulls the sea towards it on the side of the earth that is nearer to it, and pulls the solid earth towards it more than it pulls the sea on the side that is further away. Every 24 hours, that rocky earth makes a full revolution within its ill-fitting sea envelope, so that each point on the coast comes in turn to luxuriate in deep sea and be exposed in the shallows, a rhythmic coming and going of the tide, as if this were some teasing planetary game of I love you, I love you not. The presence of the moon makes the water bulge, but the turning of the earth makes the tides. In the Newtonian picture, it is not the water that moves when the tide rises or falls, but the rocks of the planet rotating within the skin of sea. The spin of the earth drives these headlands and islands through the water sphere that encases them, a sea that remains effectively almost still in space. Watch water draining out over the lip of a tidal pool, or making its way in between the boulders at the head of a beach on a rising tide, and you are watching the earth turn. Find yourself in a tide race full of turbulence and overfalls, and you are feeling not the potency of the sea, but the giant flywheel of the earth itself, its huge angular momentum driving these rocks through waters that are held in place by a satellite 250,000 miles away. out in the Sound, marking the channel for bulk carriers north of the Grey Islands, there is a cardinal buoy anchored to the seabed with two upward-pointing arrows at its crest, all kinds of solar equipment on its body, and a big yellow steel hull in the sea. About a mile to the west is another, warning against Yule rocks, with only 4 feet of water over them at low water springs, this one a red steel can, flashing at night its steady once every 15 seconds red. Up close, the buoys are bewitching objects. When a big tide is running, the flood sets northwest at 2 knots or more, the ebb southeastward scarcely less. Both buoys tip in the current, tugging and jolting at the chains that hold them to the floor of the Sound. Both look for all the world as if they are making their way through the sea, which rubs up into a bow wave around their tubby, tug-like bodies. That is the Newtonian reality. According to the vision in Principia Mathematica, it is the floor of the Sound that is turning within the sea, pulling these chained vessels along with it like a pair of reluctant hounds. They must stay in the same place in relationship to the Earth, but seen by an aerial observer out in the universe, they make a long and troublesome journey every 24 hours, following the Earth to which they are bound. To see the tide running is to see quite literally the physical drive of the Earth. Not that the Moon is without its part. Two high tides do not fit exactly within the 24 hours of the Earth's rotation, because the Moon also moves around the Earth in the same direction as the Earth spins, so that every day the Moon rises 50 minutes later than on the day before, dragging the tidal bulge around with it. Each high tide is 25 minutes later than its predecessor, and so we live in the planet's embrace, pulled out towards worlds that are not our own. The Newtonian picture of a rock yolk in an ocean egg was essentially static, and throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, subtler understandings were gained of the tide as a dynamic system. Through careful calibration of records across many oceans, it emerged that each ocean in each hemisphere had its own almost independent tidal regime. Each ocean was its own Galilean pond. Here, in the North Atlantic, as the Earth turns towards the rising moon in the east, the waters off the coast of Senegal are drawn to it. As the moon begins its transit of the Atlantic, sliding steadily west across America, the bulge of water it makes does not follow immediately beneath it along the lines of the Earth's latitudes, but, like any movement in ocean or atmosphere, turns to the right, the Coriolis effect, and begins to flow north up around the rim of the ocean basin, performing a giant oceanic circle. If the high tide is flooding into the bay at, say, 9 in the morning, that tide began its life off the coast of Senegal at midnight. It pushed north, and the peak of the wave reached the Canaries by 4 in the morning. Lisbon, an hour later, was in the Bay of Biscay at 6, and off Land's End as dawn broke at 7 in the morning. Only an hour after that, it was rounding the northwest point of Donegal in Ireland, while two of its subsidiary tongues pushed slowly and laboriously, thickening as they went, into the Irish Sea and eastwards, just as slowly up the English Channel towards Dover. The tide that came up the outside of Ireland travels fast, reaching the west end of Mull by 8:30 in the morning and flooding here into the bay half an hour later, a mere 9 hours after it has left Dacca, 3,000 miles away. This long, low wave sweeps on up to the north of Scotland, rounding Cape Wrath at 10, through Orkney by 1 in the afternoon, then slowing down the east coast, Edinburgh at 4, pushing into the Thames estuary at 2 the following morning. Meanwhile, the faster-running deep ocean tide, which out in the Atlantic away from coastal shallows is no more than 9 or 10 inches high, has swept up to Iceland at 11 in the morning, only an hour after it has filled the bay here in Argyll, around the southern tip of Greenland at 2 p.m. Senegal time, and Newfoundland an hour later before making its way down the Atlantic seaboard of North America and back across to West Africa to begin again. We may think of the tide as a rise and fall of the water, but the real movement is this long, fast, shallow, rotatory wave, swirling brandy-like around the ocean basins, a different wave for each ocean in each hemisphere. One more element. The drag of the tide in these shallow seas is slowing the Earth. The planet is not indifferent to the brake applied to it twice a day, so that the Earth's day is steadily growing longer by about 2 to 2.5 milliseconds every century. 500 million years ago, the Earth was rotating faster, each day was shorter, and so in the year there were more of them, perhaps about 415. Since then, the tides have been rubbing away at the rocks, and the Earth has been dragged towards stillness by the moon and sun. Every morning, I look out of the house at the tide rising in the bay. I am witnessing, unfelt by me, a world being dragged to a stop, the spin of time seeping out towards the final entropy. All will be quiet in the end, the sea at an everlasting still stand, and the oceans a pool of perfect stagnation, always at the same height, without ever ebbing or flowing. Chapter 8. Rock. If the tides are our twice-daily connection to the universe, the rocks are our ever-present library of time. The geology in this bay marks three vast life-destroying catastrophes, more global and pervasive the further back in time you go, and record one moment in which life recovered, radiating into new forms as it came back from the worst of those disasters. As I dug the pools here, it was, like any digging, a journey into the forgotten, through the skins of which this place is made, into the litter of the past. Rocks go long. To cut into them is not a digging, but an unpeeling, slowly revealing the story of what it has been to live and die. Those three moments of destruction were each the product of a different element, worlds transformed and life destroyed, in turn by poison gas, molten rock and ice. First, the most recent, the ice. Intermittently, 3,000 feet deep over the last 2.7 million years, glaciers streamed across this whole landscape, dragging from east to west, removing every single living thing, gouging hollows in the sound, perhaps on the line of a pre-existing river valley, so that the seabed there is now a series of basins and ridges, some parts 200 feet deep, others more than 400 at low water, the corrugations and interruptions over which the tide bumps and churns. All of that ended about 10,000 years ago, as the world started to warm. The ice wasted away, and vegetable life began to reclaim the place, first a grass tundra, then a heather and juniper prairie, and finally hazel and birch woodland, into which the great browsing herds wandered up from the south. No more than 1,500 years after the ice had gone, you would never have known it had been here. This life that is here now is evidence of a self-mending world. Almost the only memory of those traumas on this beach is half buried in the sand, a bruised and battered lump of something almost infinitely older, a boulder of Moyne schists, some of the most ancient rock in Scotland, maybe a billion years old, brought here by the ice sheet from 5 miles or so further east, its body chipped and part rounded by its journey under the glacier, surviving here in the way other ice leavings have disappeared, simply because of its hardness. Photographs make it look like a miniature asteroid or a misshapen planet. What does it mean to us? Only something to watch out for when bringing a boat into the beach at half tide, a rock to which thin green weed and sprigs of channeled wrack cling. There is one other strange residue of the ice. When all the fresh water was tied up in the glaciers, the sea level was something like 300 feet lower than today. As the ice melted, the sea rose, but at the same time the vast weight of the ice was lifted from the land, and the land itself, afloat on the semi-liquid rocks of the Earth's mantle, began to bounce up, relieved of its burden in what is called the post-glacial rebound. All over the west coast of Scotland, the rebounded shores can be found as raised beaches, some in Colonsay, 135 feet above the present sea. At first, the bounce was fast, an inch a year, a foot a decade, a man's height in a man's lifetime, the whole of this coast bobbing up like the limb of a glacier that has calved and fallen into the sea. The relationship of rising sea and rising land remains unclear, but the post-glacial rebound is still happening, if more slowly, perhaps at 1 to 3 millimetres a year. It is probably just keeping ahead of the rising sea level. It may be that in the 30 years I have known this bay, it has risen 90 millimetres, 3 or 4 inches, the land itself creeping upwards out of the flood, so that the shore I now know at the lowest of low tides is a sliver wider, the paring of a single fingernail, dwindled and thinned to the fringe, as Gerard Manley Hopkins described the crescent of a new moon rising in all its slowness around the rim of the bay. Next in this catalogue of disasters came the volcano that erupted in Mull between 58 to 60 million years ago. Fountain after fountain of the basalt poured from the vents. The Atlantic was opening and a plume of core heat was breaking into the surface layers, so that the volcanic rocks coated everything beneath them to the depth of 3,000 feet, a dark match to the ice that millions of years later would overlie them. The upper reaches of the cliffs above the bay are made of those successive flows, as is the whole mountain of Glas Vaigne behind them, and the hills on the far side of the sound, in Mull, where flow after flow steps up the mountainsides, stacked like flagstones in a yard. The eruptions poured out over a paradisiacal world. In some parts of Mull, layers of life have been preserved between successive lava flows and ash storms. In these crushed and concealed horizons, red volcanic soils thickened on the rocks, and in them a beautiful warm country flora emerged, whose leaves and fruits, even some insect wings and bodies, can be found compressed as if in the pages of a plant collector's journal. The finest, at Ard Toon in Mull, are thought to have fallen into the still waters of a lake or quiet river, ferns, magnolias, oaks and planes. In other places, several whole pine trees were overwhelmed with the liquid lavas enclosing them, in a scene that is almost impossible to visualise. A rock engulfment to a height of 20 or 30 feet, where they stand today, surrounded by the twisted forms of the solidified lavas. I have looked among the basalts of the bay for these precious signs of life 58 million years ago, but there is none. The dark and heavy rock is as lifeless now as when it came up out of the volcano. It preserves the mineral blankness of its origins as much as any fossil preserves its form of life, made in an instant without a history. Sometimes at the top of a flow, where the lava was frothy and full of gas, and its consistency mousse-like, the holes in the mousse, or amygdales, as geologists call them from the Greek for almonds, filled with quartzite liquids, and this mousse stone survives on the beach as little satellite bodies, the dark brown stone speckled with white, as pretty as chocolate chip, but in truth only another glimpse into sterility. The third episode here, at which life was removed from this world, is the oldest and by far the most unsettling. At Rua Untasenach, where I made my second pool, the hard grey limestones are the most sobering of all remnants, a ruin of life, a monument to emptiness. They mark one of the great crises in existence, a moment at which it is not too much to say that life almost died. They come from just after the episode known to geologists as the End Triassic Extinction, the ETE, 201 million years ago. There are sermons in stones, and these ones are terrifying. This place was somewhere in the latitude of the Mediterranean, warm and life-filled. Here was not here, but was, nevertheless, undeniably here. Its substance, then, is here now. And so, in here not here, slowly far beyond the consciousness of any organism, unrolling over about 600,000 years, disaster happened. All the continents of the world had been gathered together in a single supercontinent, Pangaea, the whole Earth, surrounded by a single ocean, on some edge of which this bay was then to be found. Giant convective cycles within the mantle set to work, and Pangaea began to break. Over a good proportion of the Earth, about 4 million square miles, across what is now Brazil and Nigeria, Newfoundland and southern Europe, an area called the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province, CAMP, more than 500,000 cubic miles of liquid basalt came up and out of the mantle and onto the surface of the Earth. This was the breaking of Pangaea, but it was not the basalt as much as the gases that came with it that caused the catastrophe. Carbon dioxide and methane came blowing out of the rifting planet into the atmosphere and absorbed by the ocean. Geologists have calculated that CAMP emitted something over 20 million tons of CO2 a year for about 500,000 years, a total of some 10,000 billion tons, in addition to 5,000 billion tons of methane. These figures may mean little, but there is a comparison to bring one up short. Our modern industrial life emits 10 billion tons of CO2 every year, 500 times the annual amount coming into the atmosphere at the end of the Triassic. This is what happened then. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose to between 10 and 200 times its present levels. A ferocious global greenhouse developed, and the Earth started to burn. Sea temperatures rose. Warm water can hold less dissolved salt, and so the salinity in which creatures had evolved dropped below the levels at which they could survive. Everywhere, life systems started to fail. There was less oxygen in these warm and stratified waters, and animals suffocated. The high levels of CO2 began to acidify the sea. Corals and creatures whose life structures depended on the making of hard protective calcified shells and armatures, including many calcareous phytoplankton, found it at first difficult and then impossible to keep going. Experiments recreating these conditions in which carbon dioxide blankets the Earth have led to the shell-making animals developing strange and malformed versions of themselves. The volcanic rifting and its associated gases continue to pour from the CAMP. On land, much of all previous life was removed. Niche after niche was emptied. About 80% of all species and nearly all life died. Genera after genera went extinct, particularly at sea. Heavy and suffocating blooms of green phytoplankton sucked yet more oxygen out of the water. The floor of the world's oceans was coated in thick layers of black, oxygenless muds. Nothing could breathe, almost nothing could live. For 8 million years afterwards, there were no coral reefs on Earth. The rocks Rua und Tassonach were made as that moment ebbed, just as the sea began to become less acid, but before life could recolonize it. The stone here is still utterly lifeless. The entire headland is a fossil of lifelessness, limestones accumulating in an ocean where next to nothing lived, a heartbeat away from the ending of the whole of life. Something of that is communicated by the stone. Unlike, say, a fossil-rich limestone in Portland, or even the chalk, the sheer blankness of these rocks, gradually now being dissolved again in a newly acid sea, still looks and feels like the remains of a derelict post-anoxic planet, an earth layer in which hundreds of millions of lives had struggled and failed, dying in the chemical hostility of a poisoned planet. If the balance had been only slightly different, if the volume of outgassing had been slightly higher or had gone on for longer, nothing would have survived. But it did, and we are here, you reading, me writing, life squeaked through. This sea here today in front of me is performing as a sink for half the CO2 that is expelled by the burning of fossil fuels. The absorbed gas is acidifying the water now as it did 200 million years ago, making life difficult for the shell builders, all the periwinkles and whelks, the crabs and hermit crabs, the prawns and squat lobsters, even for the bony fish which will have trouble building their skeletons in an acid sea, and for the birds that must concentrate the calcium for their bones and eggs. An acid sea is hostile to the life forms we have loved to find in it. Ever-continuing greenhouse gas emissions will deliver only a kind of ubiquitous and dominant green mush, at least for the next few million years. Life did recover, and the head of the bay outside the house is full of evidence for that resilience. The rocks there are the residues of the reoccupied levels, the matrix of the recovery after the ETE crisis was over, when the basalt had ceased to flow, the gases were no longer polluting the atmosphere, and the earth had begun its low and slow rebalancing. Over millions of years, the oceans de-acidified and life started again. It was the beginning of one of the great ages, the Jurassic, life remaking itself in a global act of persistence, a return to possibility. In the 200 million years that have elapsed since then, the level beds in which the mud and limey clays of the new post-Pangaea seas were originally laid down have been played with by earth movements and tipped about 30 or 40 degrees up from the horizontal. The sea has then cut roughly across them, like a blunt saw through a sheet of marine ply, so that what was once stacked neatly one bed above the other is now revealed as a low but jagged series of peaks and troughs across the intertidal. I dug my first pool into one of those troughs. I soon understood that the rocks were making their own signals to me. The layers in them were pulsed, a regular and rhythmic sequence that repeated again and again, the same three layers, one above the other, a hard grey-blue limestone, a soft lime-rich clay, and some dark, finely laminated black shales. The limestone broke off in chunks if I hit it with a sledgehammer or a pickaxe. I could slice away at the clay, which had a consistency somewhere between cheddar and brie. In it were some rounded lumps of iron-rich sandstone, the size of goose eggs, which I could rootle out with one of my wrecking bars like nuts from a cake. And finally the shale shivered off in showers of millimetre flakes when I attacked it with a jemmy. Slowly I deepened the pool through these layers. Something had happened here which had this rhythm built into it. The geologists are not agreed. It seems clear, at least, that there was a repeated shallowing and then re-deepening of the sea, a steady flux and reflux across time. The dark black shales are not unlike the worldwide seas of the ETE, the fossilized muds on the dark, fine-grained and anoxic floor of a relatively deep sea in which no life could persist, much like the floor of the Black Sea now. From slightly shallower seas is the grey clay with the egg nodules in it. These nodules, the scientists agree, are concretions of the iron-rich elements when pressurized by the rock layers above. The last is the hard limestone, which is solid with the fossils of a richly curved and sculpted early oyster called Gryphia arcuata, the hooked griffin in Linnaean Latin, the devil's toenail for the pre-scientific. This stone was laid down in a warm, clear and shallow sea, not unlike the Bahamas now. In all, a single repetition of the rock sequence records the passing of about 38,000 years of the early Jurassic Sea. Half of it is the limestone, about a fifth the clay, and the rest the dark shales. Again and again, for millions of years, the pattern repeated. The sea came and went, deepened and shadowed, not arbitrarily, but metronomically, pulsing and fluxing as a tide, one of the slowest of all the Earth's many songs. In the 1920s, the Serbian mathematician and astronomer Milutin Milankovic established that the movements of the Earth were governed by a series of interlocking and repeated cycles. The planet was not fixed on some cosmic armature, but was afloat in its gravity field. One cycle, 90,000 years long, reflects the coming and going of the Earth's orbit around the Sun, pulled this way and that by the gravities of Jupiter and Saturn, so that the ellipse of its year stretches and contracts over time. Another cycle, perhaps a long-lasting effect of a collision with another body at the time the Earth and Moon were formed, marks a wobble, 20,000 years long, in which, like a slowing top, the rotational axis of the Earth itself rotates. The third, and the one that has shaped this beach, is subtle, a slight shifting back and forth by a few degrees every 40,000 years or so in the Earth's axis of rotation. Over that period, the Earth tilts to and fro, towards and then away from the Sun. When at maximum tilt, the seasons are more extreme, more sun in the summer, less in the winter. As the Earth comes upright, the seasons rebalance and become more like each other. At the moment, we are half-tipped, halfway through one of these cycles, and so the seasons are neither extreme nor particularly mild. The early Jurassic wobbled to and fro as we do. At maximum tip and maximum seasonality, the summers had no difficulty melting the winter snows. At minimum tip, the summers were cool, the winter snows did not melt, and both ice caps and glaciers grew. Minimum tip was, in other words, an ice age. Maximum tip, an age of near-Siberian shifts each year from heat to cold. And so this is the picture here 200 million years ago. We were in the subtropics, far south of any ice sheet. The climate flowed around us. When summers were cool, volumes of water were locked up in the ice sheets, and the sea level was low. The bay at those moments was in the warm shallows of somewhere like the Caribbean. Gryphia sat in the surface of the pale, oozy mud on the seafloor, filtering their plankton food from the turquoise waters above them. As summers warmed, with the turning of the Milankovitch cycle, sea level rose. The sea here deepened, and it became a place first of clay ooze, then of ever deeper, dark and anoxic muds. Ammonites and other animals fell to the bottom and were preserved there. Within time, the tilt began to turn, the summers cooled, the ice grew, the sea level dropped, and we were once again in the warm, life-loving shallows. These rocks record that rhythmic earth. I took some pieces of the rock back to the house where there is a bench against the bay-facing wall. A spring morning. I sat there with a small hammer and the lumps of Jurassic seafloor, and began to tap and chisel at the laminations. My copy of Mesozoic Fossils, a cup of coffee, cold sunshine. First, the hard limestone in which the gryphias cluster in such thick bands, but they are difficult to dig out of the stone. Its concreted grip is fierce, and I had little success. In places, though, the oysters have already fallen out of their matrix and lie smoothed and ready polished on the beach. One I picked up and treasure is a pair of the little griffins, clamped in each other's arms, yinned and yanged into each other's hollows. Another had its lid in place where the muscle of the animal had clamped it 200 million years ago. Where the sea creatures further out from the shore dropped into the dark muds at the bottom of the sea and were preserved there, they are easier to disinter. In one of the sandstone nodules were the fleeting remains of an ammonite, too blurred to identify its species, a splay of curved indents, nothing more. The finely laminated shales were the best. Soon their flaky pastry began to fall apart in my fingers. Out of it came the little fossilized creatures that had died and fallen into the mud. First part of a tiny shell, as if of a slightly asymmetric queen scallop, but impossible to align with anything in the handbook, Then, best of all, a pair of tiny cockles, smaller than my little fingernail, about the size of a hazelnut, picked out of its shell. They were Calcirrhynchia calcarea, finely cast, with the joint between upper and lower shell dipping down in the centre, as if with a pouting lip. These things that look like life and carry all the signatures once made by life are not now life, and for one reason. They are over. They have no future, but merely indicate the place where life once was, lacking the one identifying mark of the living, an openness to time, a vulnerability to risk, a readiness to enter again and again the furnace of existence. They have become, almost literally, monuments to themselves. Everything they once were has already been burned away. The sympathetic and reproachful ghost of the great Victorian naturalist Philip Henry Goss, 1810 to 1888, hangs over this story of life, fossils and the pools. Goss was the fundamentalist king of the Victorian shore. Almost alone, he had invented the view of it as a place in which to see God's world in miniature. He loved the intertidal, knew it as well as anyone, promulgated its beauties, made a career of it, encouraged thousands to love it as he did, and finally failed to understand the essence of what he saw. He was the son of a semi-successful miniaturist from Poole in Dorset, and spent his youth in Canada and America, gradually learning to examine and understand the natural world. The near death of his sister in his late 20s pushed him towards a fervent and literalist Christianity, which again and again found in nature signs of God's beneficence and of his having made a happy world. An enormous workload of papers, lectures, books and pamphlets led to nervous exhaustion, and in 1851, when only 40, he retired with his beloved wife Emily and their son Edmund to the Devon coast, where he began his researches into marine biology. He found a way of keeping sea animals and plants alive in unchanged seawater by balancing oxygenating coralline seaweeds with oxygen-consuming creatures, and his ecstatic Elysian adventures on the shore resulted in book after book, richly illustrated from his own watercolours, describing his discoveries among the life of the pools. He recognised that the beauties of God's nature were never more great than when minutely great, and the sense of wonder is palpable 2 centuries later. He loved the sight of a winkle marching soberly along beneath his massive mansion, leisurely circumambulating the pretty tide pool which he has chosen for his present residence. Watching a barnacle wafting food into its mouth reminded him of the gospel net mentioned by our Lord, which is cast into the sea and gathers of every kind, which, when it is full, they draw to shore and sit down and gather the good into vessels, but cast the bad away. Matthew chapter 13, verses 47 to 48. He and his son Edmund spent whole summers exploring submarine gardens of a beauty that seemed often to be fabulous, their sides and floor paved with living blossoms, ivory white, rosy red, orange and amethyst, the great prawns gliding like transparent launches, anthea waving in the twilight its thick white waxen tentacles, and the fronds of the dulse faintly streaming on the water like huge red banners in some reverted atmosphere. Emily developed cancer, and in 1857 died an agonising death. Goss was left alone with Edmund, for whom he had promised Emily on her deathbed the strictest and most rigorous of Christian upbringings. The desire for the consolations of changelessness, for the denial of catastrophe and the pattern of life, became overwhelming. That platonic longing for a perfect and eternal world of stillness beyond this one, a pool in which truth, beauty and goodness could have their everlasting being, and where change was unknown, led him to write Omphalos, an attempt to untie the geological knot. It was the most elaborate and maddest effort ever made to deny mutability in living things, and to see in the facts of nature the mind of an eternal God, who in the 6 days of creation made every animal and plant as they now were and ever would be. Omphalos, he wrote, would offer a stable resting place for those who were troubled by the apparently irreconcilable differences between the account in Genesis of God's creation and the evidence of the rocks. By the 1850s, the tectonic plates were stirring around traditional Christians. The stone book seemed to say the Bible was wrong. Rocks from the Silurian seas lay 50,000 feet thick. Some coral reefs were 2,500 feet deep. Fossils of enormous frogs the size of a hippopotamus had been found. Creatures in the fossil record had appeared, lived, bred and died for thousands on thousands of successive generations. Sometimes the whole existing fauna seems to have come to a sudden violent end. At others, the species die out one by one. New creatures supply the place of the old. Species change, the very genera change, and change again. Forms of beings, strange beings, beings of uncouth shape, of mighty ferocity and power, of gigantic dimensions, come in, run their specific race, propagate their kinds, and at length die out and disappear, to be replaced by other species, each approaching nearer and nearer to familiar forms. The idea of a single moment of creation was fatally challenged. These other animals, from the vast depths of time, had shells, crusts, plates, bones, horns, teeth, exactly corresponding in structure and function to those of recent animals, but body parts that seemed to have little to do with them. Millions of forest trees had grown and died, now crushed into the coal strata. Succulent plants lay in beds hundreds of feet thick, pressed together like paper pulp. None of them was like anything found in the modern world. It was, as Gosse said, a mighty array of evidence. How to reconcile its vision of the vast rolling cycles of change with anything in Genesis? He who made the world is one Jehovah, who cannot be inconsistent with himself. But people cannot shut their eyes to the startling fact that the records which seem legibly written on his created works do flatly contradict the statements which seem to be most plainly expressed in his word. Some hoped it could all be explained by Noah's flood. Others suggested the early world might have developed very quickly, and that all the layers of the rocks could have been laid down by God in a week. Just because the world develops slowly nowadays did not mean to say it did so in the past. Maybe the 6 days of creation were just a manner of speaking. Perhaps each day was many millions of years long. Or there may have been many worlds before this one, and this was the one made in 6 days some 6,000 years ago. For one idea, Gosse reserved particular scorn. An author had hatched a scheme by which the immediate ancestor of Adam was a chimpanzee and his remote ancestor a maggot. Gosse's own solution was ingenious. At the moment of creation, God did not make individual adult animals. No animal exists in its adult state. Every plant and animal is dependent on a life cycle that has embedded in it the process of generation, from adult to egg, to embryo, to child, to adult. And so God did not make animals, he made life cycles. Creation was the sudden bursting into a circle, an eruption into the processes of life, each species of which, from the first, would continue to generate the potential that God had put into it. Every plant and creature was made with its whole past and future implicit in it. This is the idea that lies behind the title of the book. Omphalos is the Greek for navel. Even though God had made Adam whole and adult, he would have given him a navel because the cycle of life, his own generation and birth, required it. Gosse's conception was explicitly miraculous. The first butterfly had already been a caterpillar. All creatures were created with the evidence in them of their having lived before they were created, an impossibility, but an aspect of the divine miracle. He asked his readers to imagine the morning of creation on a rocky shore. In this weed-fringed tide pool, there is a fine specimen of the shore crab, Carcinus minus. It is a male, just arrived at the perfection of adult age, its carapace smooth and wholly dark green in hue, its underparts rufous orange. To all appearance, this crab is several years old, but four distinct metamorphoses were passed before the commencement of this form, and before this there was the egg, which was laid by the mother crab. All these evidences of age, clear and unanswerable though they are yet fallacious, because the crab has been created but this morning. This was the crux. Not only were the creatures made with their past and future already implicit in them, the earth itself and all its life was made, in this one week of creation, with its past pre-enclosed in its rocks. God made the fossil record as he made the world. It was a solution to the painful dilemma. Just as the first trees had rings in their timber, the first shells had growth lines, and the first man had a navel, the earth itself had all the cycles of its own immense past embedded in it. It may be objected, Goss wrote, that to assume the world to have been created with fossil skeletons in its crust, skeletons of animals that never really existed, is to charge the Creator with forming objects whose sole purpose was to deceive us. His answer was straightforward and unanswerable. The law of creation supersedes the law of nature. God made the world with the past that was natural to it. His contemporaries thought it absurd. Those who believed in God did not like to think of him as a deceiver. Those who valued the findings of science could not accept this distorting of the evidence. Almost at a stroke, the hero of an entire generation of shore lovers had his reputation destroyed. As Darwinian ideas rapidly took hold, and it was increasingly understood that flux, chance, and change were the governors of life on Earth, Goss became a fossil, an entirely coherent but entirely previous form of existence that had suffered its catastrophe and from which the world had moved on.